The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.
I'm joined this morning by Mark Hennessy, Ireland and Britain editor with the Irish Times, Ursula Savage, political commentator, and Francis Fitzgerald, Fine Gael, just until recently Fine Gael MEP for Dublin, and of course, former Minister for Justice for Enterprise and the Taoiseach. So there is much relating to your party, Francis, that we need to talk about in the papers this morning. Maybe, Mark, I might kick off with you to give us a sense of the state of play, because the Business Post has done one of its Red Sea polls. It has given us a breakdown of where the parties all stand, and one of the inferences that it is making into where all of the parties stand, there you go, you can borrow mine, where all the parties stand, is that there's now going to be even more pressure on Simon Harris to pull the trigger and get on with this election.
Yeah, Fine Gael up 2 points, Sinn Féin down 2, Fianna Fáil down 1, Independents settling at 15, and the Greens down 1, and Sock Dems plus 1, Independent Ireland minus 1. Now, obviously, with the margin of error, the smaller figures there can be taken with a certain grain of salt. It does increase pressure, although every time the Taoiseach speaks publicly, he narrows his ground. So normally you would expect a politician to leave a certain degree of wriggle room, but his IBIC speech on Monday night has again narrowed that ground. So the question is, if he were to change his mind in November, would the issue become, well, are you lying to us now or were you lying to us before or whatever? Now, whether that would be just a 24-hour...
Although, is there any political consequence to that? Does anybody care if he changes his mind?
I'm not sure. I mean, you know, there's an argument that it becomes an issue about truthfulness and all of the rest of it. And then there's an argument that it's just a storm and a teacup and it'll disappear. The one thing that is clear talking to people in government is that they haven't made up their mind. Everybody I've spoken to, there's nobody who, everybody can give you an argument in favour of November. Everybody can give you an argument in favour of March, although the numbers on that side are fewer and the arguments are weaker in many cases. And there is an expectation on the part of a great number of them that they would prefer to go in November. But the reality is, anybody who has been involved in election campaigns, November is the worst of all months.
Well, you see, this I've been reflecting on. Is November that radically different to February? It's not like February is this basking, glorious sun.
No, it's not, but you're on the other side, you know?
Is it that significant? It's hardly August versus January.
I mean, you don't get an opportunity to do any sort of street campaigning in November. And that's even if you got a dry November, right? So it becomes a TV...
February, though? Well, February's manky, Mark.
No, of course it is, but I'm not talking about February. I'm talking about
this
March.
This summer was pretty bad, you know? Too.
I mean, the argument is that you go to March and then you have the extra hour. Now, you know, then you've any government that does that has completely boxed itself in against whatever issue is going on the ground. If they decide to go for November now, there'll be an argument made. Well, you kept telling us it was going to be full term, so what's change of mind? Is there something you're not telling us and all of that?
You know? Ursula, do you think they are all, and Simon Harris prime amongst them, sick to the back teeth of answering the same question repeatedly? You know that line about repeating the same action and expecting a different result is madness? I think the question must now have been asked a couple of hundred times of them, and the answer is always the same. We're waiting for March.
Easily, yeah, and I think it's kind of one of those things, again, we were saying there, like, why has he kind of been so steadfast and, like, so definite in every answer that he's given to that question? And it's probably because he's said it so many times at this stage. But for himself, I'm sure, looking at those poll numbers this morning, he'll be thinking, March is a very long time away if I'm sitting on these poll numbers now. And every time that he's come out being so, so definite and answered the question hundreds of times, you would think maybe at some stage he would start just bringing in a little bit of ambiguity just to give himself the option, because he really isn't. He's going to have to do it. It'll look like a massive U-turn at this stage anyway. But you think he'd just kind of open it up for himself a bit, say, well, considering this and the budget's done and maybe they'll get some big policy piece sorted out or legislation.
That's not a bit like being a little bit pregnant. Can you have ambiguity about whether or not the election's in March?
You can have ambiguity about everything. Do you know, but just you know, we'll finish out our work programme, or, you know, we'll do this, we'll do that. You just don't have to be so definite. For himself, I think, it's kind of a strange to back yourself into a corner so definite, because it's a problem of his own making now if he thinks that we have to run to March, because I've said this so many times. Although, that said, I think if he did say, actually, we're going to go in November now, it might be talked about for a day, that you know, he said so many times that he wasn't going to and he changed his mind. But after that, you would just be into the campaign. And also the campaigning really has started already with Sinn Féin coming out with their housing policy and their talk about childcare and everything that's going on there. So it'll be a very, very long campaign and a very, very long winter for everyone involved if the election isn't happening in March.
Now, usual caveats applying that it is only the Taoiseach who knows his own mind, yada, 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 and he's made his position clear. The arguments on either side of it, Francis, from your perspective, if you were making the call and you're looking at the kind of polls we have now, what's the argument for hanging on to March, regardless of the fact that he's worn a hole in an iron pot saying it? What's the advantage?
Thankfully, I'm not making the decision. And the good news story, of course, for Fine Gael this morning is plus 16 seats, up 5%, a 5% differential between Sinn Féin and Fianna Fáil. So
Simon Harris's phone will be melted with backbenchers and potential candidates saying, go for it, Simon.
Well, undoubtedly. I mean, there is a tsunami of people saying you should have it now. And I think the phrase he's used recently quite a bit is, you know, I gave a commitment to the party leaders. I was asked to the other party leaders, you know, would I give a commitment to a full term? That was the pressure that was on him when he became leader, and he gave that. And we know that it's, at the end of the day, it's his decision.
Yeah, but what does full term define? Like, you get your fifth budget out of the way. That's full term.
This is a coalition. So look, Anton, a week is a long time in politics. Let's face it. I think whatever decision he makes, people, the public will just get on. This is an election campaign. We get on with it, and we ask people to vote for us. I think the arguments, clearly everybody is saying the arguments are more in favour of going before Christmas. I don't think there's that much difference weather-wise or anything between November and February, actually.
Mark has strong feelings about
February. He's more optimistic about February than I am.
Not on February.
I've done February elections. They're not great.
No, they're not.
I mean, you know, listen, the nicest elections in the spring, but you're not going to get that. So one way or another, it's not, weather-wise, it's kind of neither here nor there. The question, I suppose, for Fine Gael is, with so many new candidates, is there much more time for them to become known in their local constituencies if you delay the election longer? And, you know, does the brand and the individuals who are now running for us, all those new candidates, I think we've 51 new candidates in Fine Gael. Yeah. So, you know, there is that kind
of
argument.
You also expose yourselves, I would have thought, to Reynolds's great quote about the little things. A lot of little things can happen in three or four unpredictable months.
Undoubtedly. It must be very tempting, you know, when you see the headline like today in the Business Post, pressure in Harris mounts to call early election. But I think he'll stay fairly grounded on it. And he's been very clear all the time that he wants to go as far as possible in terms of continuing, you know, to deliver the policies and to work with the coalition leaders. But the strains are beginning to show. You can see that.
No doubt about that. And you could see the interview with Roderick O'Gorman today, who's expressing grumbles about his partners in government. And equally, there are actions taking place within government that are giving themselves at least an each way bet. The energy credits are all going to be paid in advance of Christmas, you know, small things they're not small things. In many households, they'll be very significant. You'll have the budget. There's talk about fast tracking a lot of the budget welfare changes instead of having them coming in the new year. So, you know, all their actions would appear to be heading them down the road of a November election. And yet the rhetoric is still talking about March. At some point, that's going to have to clarify.
Explain to me then what has caused the numbers in your view that we currently have. Because obviously the interesting ones are why Fianna Fáil is languishing is the wrong phrase, but why they are static, because they're down 1%, which is margin of error stuff. Fine Gael up significantly. And Sinn Féin, despite the big Eoin Óibrín housing policy, which was this sort of junior crown policy platform, it doesn't seem to have had an effect.
Well, we were just talking about that beforehand. I think, to be fair to Sinn Féin, I think there's a caveat that you have to put in there. This poll was taken a few days after the housing policy was announced. And given the audience that they're looking for to vote for Sinn Féin, that audience is not watching the 9 o'clock news. They're not listening to a lot of radio and a whole variety of other things. So they're getting their news through social media. And sometimes that can take slightly longer to filter through. So now, that's one explanation. The other explanation, of course, is that they don't think much of the policy. But, you know, we'll see. You would have to assume that the Sinn Féin policy is at least attractive to some people. So I'd hold off on any kind of final...
Except we do have a trend, Mark. We're down from, 30-odd percent height, and that line just continues. If you were Sinn Féin, you would be deeply concerned, wouldn't you?
Well, yeah, of course you would. I mean, clearly they've had a pretty awful 6 or 8 months, and, you know, they've lost out on the immigration liberation debate, a lot of their working class support, or what would they would describe as that, has become extremely irritated by the whole issue of immigration. And then other sectors of voters have become irritated by Sinn Féin's response to the issue. So they're losing on both different sides. But at the end of the day, Sinn Féin will win or lose in this campaign on the issue of housing. And their policy has to be greeted with welcome by people who want to buy a house in the next 5 years and who will be prepared to come out and vote. And if they don't motivate that core of people, they're going nowhere.
Well, you see, that's the thing.
You have to give great credit to Simon Harris for his leadership and for that new energy and the new vision, and that he has engaged with the public so significantly over the summer. And, you know, I think it's seen in these results. Mm-hmm. And there is a, you know, the whole question of leadership.
So you attribute the Fine Gael gains specifically to Simon Harris?
I do,
that's the
yes.
Harris hop.
I do think so. Yeah. I think he's made a huge difference.
I don't think there's any.
And I don't think there's any doubt about that. I think that sense of, you know, of energy, of connecting with the public, of responding to every single question he's asked when he's interviewed, I think people are getting a real sense of him, and I think that's going to continue. And the question, of course, is how much is honeymoon, how much of it is going to be sustained? I saw somebody taking a lash at him saying, does he think he's so great he's going to go on forever like this? We all know politics is up and down. Mm. But I think it's been very significant.
But does it explain the Sinn Féin drop? Because
no,
the Sinn Féin drop has been a continuum now for about 18
months.
That's
very interesting, and it must be very worrying for them, because I mean, I remember at the beginning of the European election campaign, they were in the late 20s and everybody else was way down. And then they went down to about 11 and 13.
The presumptive party of government
until recently. It's kind of extraordinary. And the whole media talk was actually, it was almost inevitable they would be in government, you know.
Was the sense. It was who's going to be the junior partner.
Yes.
Is it the immigration thing, Ursula? Is that why it's hard to...
I don't think it's any one thing. I really don't. And I do think what you're saying about Harris's new leadership coming in and the energy that that's brought, that probably has pulled focus away from Sinn Féin. So perhaps they're maybe just not as visible to the electorate at all times. So even though they are bringing out these policies and they are doing that, they're just not in front of people's eyes often enough to really keep the attention on them. And that's really what they need between now and the election, whenever that should happen. Although I do wonder, whenever we're talking about the levels of energy that Simon Harris has brought, we talked there about how sustainable is that going to be between now and if it was March. I wonder, is the fact that so many of the Fine Gael TDs are not going to be standing in this election, will that start to have an impact on the levels of energy or the levels or the perceived levels of enthusiasm? Whenever you know that your local TD is kind of just waiting until the next election before they're able to step down on their own terms, which I'm sure is a nice thing for a TD to be able to do at any stage, and when you know that somebody else is waiting in the wings, or, you know, are they lining up another job, or are they ready for retirement, or you would start to wonder, like, are they just kind of like,
the argument against that is the enthusiasm which you saw in Tullamore at the thinking of the new people who are really thrilled to be running,
I'm
and
sure
very energised.
Are ready to get stuck in, so
still,
maybe March is a long time away for them too.
But there's still the challenge. You know, we know that name recognition is so important in politics, so there's a big challenge that, you know, the new candidates become known in their constituencies and, you know, get the leaflets out and the meetings going.
I saw the Fisher kind of out in public a few times over the summer, and, I mean, obviously it's a political brand that won't last because these things always evaporate. But he has a temporary period where he has the possibility of doing what Bertie did in 97, that really publicly focused campaign around the leader with, you know, you remember Bertie, you know, going down every street and shopping centre in the state and everybody coming towards him as distinct from running away from him. Harris, for a very short period of time, is there. It's not going to last. The question is, does it last until March?
We're talking about winners and losers. I suppose the ones who must be deeply depressed in all of this are the two parties about whom we haven't spoken at all, Labour and the Greens. Are we writing epitaphs at this point?
Well, you'd have to assume that the Greens are looking at a bad day, which is, you know, ironic or odd in a way when the climate crisis is becoming as prevalent.
What are they on, 4%? Is it
4%, I think, yeah.
And Labour about the same?
Labour, yeah, exactly, yeah. Yeah, exactly. So, 4% for Labour as well. You know, one is suffering, as it has always suffered, by going into government in the form of the Greens. Labour are suffering because they haven't managed to define themselves in the public mind, no matter what they've done in terms of new leaders and all of the rest of it. And it is difficult to see that change between now and then. However, you know, there's always the caveat, which is maybe perhaps a get out in all of these kind of conversations. The clock does start when the election is called. You know, there are those 3 or 4 weeks where people who go from one end of the year to the other without thinking very much about politics actually start paying.
Are they that material, those weeks? Do they make that big a difference to you?
Oh, they do make a difference, yeah.
Oh, I think the elections are absolutely critical. Yeah. I mean, you can have all the opinion polls, but if there's a crisis during an election, we've seen this with parties before, we saw it with the PDs, you know, a mistake here or there, suddenly the public, and you never quite know. You know, we say housing migration are going to be the issues now, but there's always new issues that emerge. There's you know, there are these emerging issues and how parties deal with them. And I think increasingly parties are going to have really good crisis reaction teams in place to make sure they are able to manage, you know, whatever is emerging during the course of the, because it's very dynamic with social media.
Things burst into conflagration faster than they once did.
I think so.
Oh, yeah. Within seconds.
The other issue we have, of course, is what to do with the 14.2, because it's been rounding up thanks to interest while it's been in its escrow account. This is the Apple money, and there's a lot of discussion about this. There's also Michael Noonan has come back into the fray to say, go away, we were dead right in everything we did in the handling of all of this. We will discuss that after the break.
The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.
The Apple 14 billion. A lot of discussion about it, obviously, in the news this weekend as to what should be done with it. Also a lot of discussion about how we handle the process and what implications there are for us in terms of FDI and in terms of international reputation. To the first of those, Ursula, as you look at it, the options for what to do with it are what? Because I assume it can't be carved up and handed to everybody in the budget, even as much as they might like to.
As nice as that would be. But I think it's one of those things I was saying before we come in here. It's, you know, whenever somebody has to pay you back a bit of money, or, you know, maybe you've cancelled a holiday and you get the money back, and in your head you'll say, I shall spend it on that. And then later on you say, well, sure, I'll spend that money on that, and that money can go towards that. And very soon you've spent it a whole lot of times and you maybe have nothing to show for it at the end at all. But I don't think you could have that same problem with 14 billion. I think that's probably a wee bit of a different scenario there. It's difficult because there's that many different, you know, claims on it. There's that many different ideas flying about. But then at the same time too, there's the talk going around that capital projects are at capacity. There's that much going on already. How do you spend this in a way that's not going to contribute to the inflation problem? Really, it's a nice problem to have, obviously, but, you know, that's probably a bit simplistic to say. But the different things that they could put it into is maybe investing it in ways in smaller projects. Maybe it's not some big, flashy policy or project that's needed for this. Maybe it's, right, well, we'll take a look at the small things that have been underfunded and see what we can do that's not going to have that. I'm thinking if you could, off the top of my head, upgrade equipment in our hospitals. It's not capital expenditure as such. It's not going to create jobs. It's not going to, you know, do these kind of things. But, you know, you could do a lot of those things in a lot of different sectors and not hopefully have those negative consequences. I don't know.
Surely there is a right way to do this, Mark, in that if I was being very simplistic and I said, look, if this was a household budget and you discovered you had had a bit of a win in the lottery and you had the choice of paying down your existing mortgage debt, doing an extension on the gaff or spending it on the Hollier, what you do is pay down the debt. We have 200 billion quid's worth of national debt. Surely that's where this goes.
Well, yes, indeed. However, let me be...
putting that to one side.
Putting that to one side for a moment and let me be the grouch in the corner. Before we start spending 14 billion, we better make sure that we hold on to 14 billion because the amount of self-flagellation that we've gone on with over the last week, as if somehow this is unalloyed good news when it actually raises serious questions about Ireland's ability to compete in the FDI world in future. First of all, other countries are almost certainly going to make a pitch to get some.
Already are. Germany and Spain.
Germany and Spain are already talking about it. Somebody is going to have a cut off this. So a lot of this money could end up having to be left in the escrow account for God knows how long while people fight over the dividends. So there's that. Now, obviously, if the money comes through the gap, then, you know, there is that the point you made that there are demands that could be met in terms of paying down debt, politically unsustainable. Any government might be able to make some contribution towards dealing with some of the debt, but there would be a huge amount of demands. And really the question is whether we can confine those demands to capital spending so that we have something that will last out of this money, or whether we'll end up in a situation where it will be wasted, or not wasted, but built into current spending.
And when you say capital, we're talking bridges, motorways, hospitals, those
something like that. You know, that we have that we end up with something that we can call the Apple Road, the Apple Hospital, or whatever it is, because otherwise we've just wasted it. But I, you know, there's a much broader thing here. There is the issue about other countries taking a cut off it. There's the issue about the future of Ireland's tax attractiveness and general attractiveness to multinationals at a time when all of them are complaining about infrastructure. And certainly, I think, you know, Matt Cooper was making the argument today that given Apple's association with Cork, that the majority of the 13 billion should be spent in Cork.
He has a dog in that fight, I think.
Well, it's good to see that he hasn't lost his roots. But, you know, there are arguments that it needs to be spent in places. But I just think we have an amazing ability to just take out the whip on ourselves, you know, and somehow that we're uniquely bad in the area of tax.
We did a sweetheart deal with the multinational that made us tens of billions of dollars over an extended period of time, Mark.
We are uniquely bad in one particular way in terms of the way in which we structured it. If you think that the French, the Germans and others are not giving huge tax breaks to multinationals in other ways, then frankly, you know, you didn't learn too much at your mother's knee, and I think you did. So you know exactly what I'm talking about.
I wish Germany and Spain luck trying to get some of this money. The way they have broken state aid rules over the last number of years is unbelievable, and the rest of Europe too. Using the argument, of course, because of economics being, you know, difficult, that they really had to break all these rules. So, you know, and even with France for many years, people used to say their effective corporation tax rate was probably about 8%, all things considered. So it is a murky area, but we have moved beyond that. We have moved to the 15% now. That was then. This is now.
Germany or Spain or whoever else. Do our other fellow member states not have a legitimate argument to point at us and say what you have been found to have done was a one-to-one sweetheart deal with a major US multinational? That major US multinational then became one of your single largest providers of corporation tax for decades at the loss, possibly, of other EU member states who might have had that investment. Therefore, cough up some of this 14 billion.
We were ahead of the posse. We had a very good approach to attract FDI. We had a corporation tax rate that actually applied to all companies. It wasn't uniquely Apple, according to Ian Guider in his article today, which is very good, where he says the money should go into helping business innovate and try and improve the economy, but also something into savings. But personally, I think the future is putting it into infrastructure, because if we want to continue for our own people to provide housing, to provide for everybody who comes to live in Ireland, we have to get that infrastructure right. And this is an opportunity to do that. It's not going to be in this budget. And there are questions, as Mark says, to see will there be other demands on it from other countries. I somehow doubt. And if there are, it's going to take a hell of a long time in the legal process to prove anything in relation to that.
Oh, you think it's noise, do you?
I think it'll be very difficult for them to get any money back from this this account, given their own attitudes to state aid and what's happening to them.
The other thing that's in that...
They may try.
Ian Guider, putting back on the hat that you once wore as Minister for Enterprise, one of the points that he's making in this, and it reflects what Mario Draghi's report revealed in recent days, is that in the period where we have suckled so happily on the FDI teat, we have been utterly unable to create our own innovation and our own unicorns and our own growth engine of enterprise, both in Ireland specifically and the EU more generally. Have we a major problem?
Absolutely. Huge problem. And you can see this. You can have a lot of good startups, both in Ireland and across Europe. Where do they go? They go to America. And there are barriers. And this is what the Draghi report was looking at this week, although it didn't get much coverage at all. I was very surprised. But basically, he does talk about having tax unity across Europe. That's one of his suggestions, which Ireland won't like very much and other countries won't like. But I mean, the whole question of how you support innovation, how you support startups, how you keep them in the country. I mean, you know that old phrase we hear, EU regulates and America innovates. And there is a worry that Europe has become, and this was very evident towards the end of the last term in Europe, that we've got too bureaucratic, too many rules, making it tougher for businesses, and that we really have to change that. And Ursula and others had moved towards saying we have to reduce the bureaucracy, the regulation. There was a real kickback against even things like corporate due diligence and putting more emphasis on, say, trade deals being more environmentally friendly and looking at human rights standards. There began to be, and that's the right thing to do, but there began a sort of a real backlash against that because of this problem of keeping innovation and the idea
and
that you need a freer market, you know.
Even beyond innovation, even our established businesses, if you look at Flutter's departure out of the Isaac to List in New York, CRH's decision to depart, and Michael O'Leary saying yesterday that effectively, other than the fact that he is forced to be European owned, Ryanair would be valued much better if he could list in New York.
Yeah, there's real challenges and we're going to have to face up to them because I think we are entering, and even though the FDI looks good in Ireland at the moment and look good for the last year, I think we are entering into a tougher, more competitive period. And you can see that recently with some of the moves to other countries. So we've really got to get our competitive base better together, really, you know.
A text that I'll put to Mark because he's our long-term weather forecaster. Anything to be said for an April election? Simon goes to the US for Paddy's Day, gets some photos for Insta with the new president, calls the general election on the flight home, April.
Last date that can be held is the 25th of March.
March.
Yeah. That puts a stake through the heart of that notion. Coming back after the break, we will be talking about that new US president and who it is likely to be, given what we've seen with the debates and the bizarre fallout since then. Back after this.
The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.
We are looking at politics across the water to the West because this has been, you get fed up saying it, but another extraordinary and bizarre week in US politics, because we had the assertion made in the debate and in a number of other settings by Donald Trump that Haitian immigrants to Springfield in Ohio were stealing domestic pets, particularly dogs and cats, and eating them. This started from his original assertion that they had begun by stealing local geese and then moved on to domestic pets.
Recording of 911 calls even show residents are reporting that the migrants are walking off with the town's geese. They're taking the geese. You know where the geese are? In the park, in the lake. And even walking off with their pets. My dog's been taken. My dog's been stolen. This can only happen. These people are the worst. I'm telling you, Biden and Kamala, this is the worst combination in the history of our country.
So this, of course, raises the question, where did all this start? Well, where it started was the vice presidential nominee, J.D. Vance, amplifying rumors that had been running around originally on Facebook relating to the theft of the cats and the dog, the theft, cooking and consumption of the cats and dogs in Springfield, Ohio, we should be clear. When he was then challenged on this, he said that the fact that there wasn't evidence was a fault not of his, but of the media.
We've heard from a number of constituents on the ground who think that it is happening, and I think that it's important for journalists to actually get on the ground and uncover this stuff for themselves when you have a lot of people saying, my pets are being abducted, or geese at the city pond are being abducted and slaughtered right in front of us. This is crazy stuff, and again, whether those exact rumors turn out to be mostly true, somewhat true, whatever the case may be, this town has been ravaged by 20,000 migrants coming in.
Now, this has led to a situation where people are looking at it saying, is this just descent into madness, or is this an attempt to create the daftest of straw men so that we don't look at something more material? One of the people who has been pushing that theory is the transport secretary and a man once considered a possible candidate for president himself, Pete Buttigieg.
This is a strategy to get us talking about the latest crazy thing that he did, whatever urban legend he amplifies. Right now it's about people eating cats or geese or whatever, because he cannot afford for us to be talking about his record. He doesn't want us talking about the fact that we lost manufacturing jobs on his watch even before COVID. He doesn't want us talking about the fact that his main economic policy promise he actually kept was to cut taxes for the rich. He doesn't want us talking about how he demolished the right to choose in this country, that he's the reason that even IVF could be banned in many places in this country. The last thing he wants us to do is to talk about his record or his agenda.
So Ursula, have we got to the point where the entire planet is analysing the completely specious theory that people are abducting cats and dogs and consuming them in Springfield, Ohio, so that the Republican nominee for president can distract from his own record?
Strangely, I'd like to think so, because the alternative is that everyone has just gone mad. So I hope there's a strategy. I hope this is a tactic. I hope that they actually sat down and thought, right, what is the straw man that we can we can dole out here. It's just so bizarre, the whole thing. It's incredible. And I think it's a very interesting tactic that J.D. Vance has there, saying like, well, I know what's happening, but, you know, like you said, the journalists, they have to go and prove it. And, you know, there's nothing, there's no accountability, there's no credibility, there's no anything there. There's no substance behind these two people at all going around saying these things. And
well, Mark, you want to defend your profession. It is the journalist's fault for not having investigated these the possible evidence of
somebody starts a daft rumour and then blames reporters for not having found evidence to support the existence of the daft rumour. I mean, you'd feel sorry for people in Springfield, no matter of what ethnic background they are, because to be caught up in something like this, it's the kind of thing in the crazy, febrile world of American politics, with the amount of guns that are around and everything else, that somebody will end up having a row in a pub one night about this and somebody will get hurt.
On Joseph's side, we've been close to that. We've seen evacuations from public buildings. Yeah, we have seen people receiving end of
threats. And you saw the police chief in Springfield say, this is utterly and completely untrue. There have been no complaints, and yet he comes out. So, you know, is it strategy or is it madness? He didn't take the advice of his own people in the debate, by all accounts. That seems to be pretty much.
Has he ever?
Good question, but he certainly didn't seem to do it on this particular occasion. And by all accounts, some of their people had their head in their hands watching the debate with Harris, and she did well, and all of the rest of whether it's well enough to make any material difference in the longer term is another thing. There was a 4 or 5 point bounce for her. But, you know, this election is being fought over 6 or 7 percentage points of the vote. Everybody else seems to have declared their colours in whatever way. So what kind of things will tip people into changing their mind? If you listen to, Trump talking about cats and dogs, does that actually make you finally convince you that you're dealing with a complete lula and you abandon him? Or do you not go to vote? You can't bring yourself to vote for Harris, but you can't bring yourself to vote for Trump, so you stay at home. All of those kind of things. I don't know. I mean, Buttigieg is absolutely right. And he is the best single communicator in the presidential campaign. He's also somebody with a tiny audience. You know, I mean, coming from where he comes from, his own personal background and history and everything else, there are so many people in the state who will just dismiss anything he says because he's a category they don't like.
What about the thing, Francis Fitzgerald, of whoever ends up winning this election, you are still left with an electorate who divided down the lines roughly 50-50 when one candidate, effectively as a racist dog whistle, suggested that Haitian immigrants were eating cats and dogs. How do you get that back in the bottle? How do you return that to being anything like a normalised political?
What it makes me think about, I mean, Ursula, you talked about maybe people have gone a bit mad, and I think you're right. There's also the policy issue, the distraction from it. But it really does, I totally agree with you, Anton. It makes you very worried about American democracy and these crazy divisions we're seeing. It's all so extreme. And, you know, it makes me, when I'm listening to the conversation over the last minute or so, makes me think about misinformation, disinformation. We're not immune in this country. I saw the police yesterday issued a warning that something was being said about some event in Dublin, that it was kids fighting. And it was, you know, there was a whole lot on social media. There was a migrant man who was at the centre of it. Untrue. Yeah. So we're seeing this sort of absolute, you know, urban rumour. And I mean, Trump uses it to the greatest extreme. And of course, it's a cover for anti-migration. And does it reassure his voters? You have to believe, sadly, that in some ways it does. These are crazy migrants who are coming in and behaving, you know,
yes,
like
even
this.
Even if that isn't true, nonetheless, immigration is a huge issue.
Exactly.
And that's what we actually care about.
So it's so ugly. And, you know, it would make you despair about American politics, actually.
But the wider strategy here and everywhere else when it comes to disinformation online is not so much to convince you that X is true. It's to convince you that everything you hear is untrue, no matter who is telling you, so that you end up in a situation where everybody is living in a world of shadows and doubt.
I think in the Sunday Independent this morning, Declan Lynch had an interesting piece where he talked about this new phrase of sane-washing. And the fact that we're having to kind of the media has to do, or in a way, is make some sort of sense of what Trump's saying, or say, oh, this must be what's going on, or maybe that's what he meant when he said that, because what he's coming out with is just absolute nonsense, but they have to engage in sort of some sort of analysis. But I think that's very dangerous. What they should be saying is that is pure nonsense.
I think this is a huge point, this sane washing. I know we came across the phrase recently, but I even saw after the debate when he went into the spin room and he said, I won this debate. Everybody knew that he didn't. And yet there wasn't a huge questioning of him when he said that. I find that extraordinary.
Yeah.
And he said,
sorry, forgive me. I mean, if you were to take some of Trump's quotes and superimpose them onto pictures of Biden, what would people be saying? When you think of how Biden
our level of tolerance for him is so high, or has been in American media.
And we've another 2 months of it. Anyway, guys, thank you very much. Ursula Savage, political commentator, Mark Hennessy, Ireland and Britain editor with the Irish Times, and Francis Fitzgerald, recent MEP for Fine Gael.
The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.